We're talking about hair discrimination and tracing the dehumanization of black hair through time on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So Pew doing the tracking here. 15 states are considering bills to prohibit hair discrimination in the workplace, in the schools. 14 states have passed bills. Wisconsin, not there yet. The Crown Act was introduced last year. It stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair Act. In Congress, we see the Crown Act has passed the House, awaits action in the Senate. Maybe you're like me and have not experienced this discrimination because you're not a Black American. Maybe you have been part of the natural hair movement and have stories to tell. Share 800-642-1234. Lori Tharps is an author and journalist, founder of My American Melting Pot, sharing Black stories in a multicultural world. Lori, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
You are a storyteller, true to your heart. Would you be willing to share a story about your hair and what you love about it?
Yeah, I would actually. My hair right now, I'm wearing my hair in dreadlocks, and I chose this style really because I thought it was beautiful and versatile, and I went natural way back in the late 1990s when going natural wasn't as popular as it is now. But when I grew the dreadlocks, my hair, that was the first time I had really just let my hair do whatever it wanted to naturally. And I was so amazed to see it grow so long because my hair had never grown long before when I used to keep it chemically straightened. So my hair was pretty much down to the middle of my back. And when I had my first child, my hair became almost like a way for my baby to hold on to me. Like he would grab onto my hair, and my hair was so strong, and it just became like a bonding point between the two of us. And over the years, I have three children, and I have since cut my locks off and grown them back again. And I always tell each child that I grew a set of locks just for them. So with each pregnancy, I grew my hair out again, you know, with the pregnancy and my hair grew together. Oh. So my hair style is significant in more than just, you know, it's a style. It also is meaningful in my life story.
Oh, I just love that image and that story. That is so beautiful and so deeply personal. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. No problem. I think a lot of Black people, our hair has been so significant. The styles we wear, really historically dating all the way back to the 15th century. And maybe people don't know the full history of the significance of different hairstyles. But we do know that our hairstyles do tend to take more time than a Caucasian person, for example. And it's often a mother, an auntie, an elder who probably has done those first styles for us. So hairstyles really do, in the Black community, tend to have more significance than just, you know, maybe a beauty trend or a fashion trend.
We're going to talk about that history in a moment, but I want to just go right to present day with the Crown Act. And you've seen this legislation being debated by states. We have the federal lawmakers now looking at legislation. What would the Crown Act do?
Well, it's interesting because people are heralding it as some sort of, you know, this would be the thing that ends discrimination against different natural hairstyles. I don't think it's going to end the discrimination because discrimination comes from, in my opinion, it comes from ignorance for the most part. And I'm saying that in the most technical form of ignorance, right? I'm not saying that it's even racist. I'm saying, generally speaking, the types of things where we see people, children being sent home from school or people not being hired from their jobs, or even grooming policies that say, you know, certain styles are not allowed because they're unhygienic or they're not professional. Most of these ideas and these policies are coming from ignorance as to what really goes into certain styles, what they mean, you know, what they signify, even how Black people maintain and care for their hair. So unless people get educated, I would assume that this discrimination is still going to continue. It's still going to continue even if we have a law that bans discrimination, because a lot of times people don't even realize that these policies that they're making were discriminatory in the first place. What's going to change if the law passes is that Black people will have some form of recourse should they be discriminated against because of their hair. So my thing is, yes, the law will be useful in that way. It might be a deterrent, but we still need education, which is why my co-author and I wrote Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America, our book, because we understand that a lot of people, both Black and non-Black, don't understand the true significance, care, meaning, history, and politics behind Black hair and its different styles, culture, and care.
We're talking with Lori Tharps about the Crown Act right now, Hair Discrimination in America. Lori, a journalist, author, Black culture expert, co-wrote a book on Black hair in America. You can join in with your questions and experiences that you have had. 800-642-1234. Lori, why don't other civil rights discrimination laws, other protections prevent hair discrimination? I mean, you talk about students being sent home from school or kept out of events like prom or sporting events and people not being able to get jobs in the workplace.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, we have Civil Rights Act. Laws that specify that discriminating against somebody based on their gender, their sexual orientation, their race, their religion, you know, those are all kind of fall into our the laws that the civil rights laws, excuse me. But there isn't one that's specifically for hair. And what's interesting about that is because all of those other, you know, things like our race, things like gender, those are immutable parts of ourself or of the human condition, if you will. But because hair is mutable, in other words, you can change it, you can color it, you can straighten it, then the law suggests that if you can change it, then it's not something that we have to protect. In other words, if we want your hair to be short, like in the military, you can cut your hair and then you are following the rules and it's okay. We can't ask you to change your skin color, right? Mm. We can't ask you to change your the place where you were born. We can't ask you to change from male to female. But if you can change something, then we can't really have a law that says that we're protecting it because it's not a immutable specific thing about you. So we need a specific law about hair because hair doesn't fall under these other topics like or these other conditions, if you will, like gender, like race, like physical ability or disability. So that's why there has to be something specific for hair and hairstyles.
I'd imagine as a researcher yourself, you're looking at the research out there. Duke University 2020 found Black women with natural hairstyles were seen as less professional, less competent than their coworkers. What is your advice to Black women on navigating hair discrimination without protections right now in the workplace?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, as somebody who has done this research for the last 20 years, a lot of men and women definitely are at the losing end of hair discrimination in the United States, Black men and Black women. But this idea that women with natural hair, for example, are discriminated or aren't taken as seriously in the workplace, that same type of research has been done about white women with curly hair, for example, that they aren't taken as seriously as their counterparts with straight hair. This, to me, is definitely an issue in that situation where we're talking about Black women and, you know, a similar experience with white women with curly hair. We're really looking at, a situation of sexism, for example, or women have to look a certain way to be taken seriously. If a Black woman or a white woman with curly hair, I just want to put them in there because these issues, I think it's really important that we realize that we shouldn't look at these things that, oh, this is just something that Black people deal with, so it doesn't apply to me. Mm-hmm. The more we can see a shared humanity, that these issues that we're talking about can affect more than, you know, just Black people. It's important so that people feel invested. So what I'm saying is that this could be an issue that affects women of multiple races. But the point is, if you are, in fact, feeling like you are the recipient of discrimination because of your hairstyle, by all means, I don't want to have anybody risk their livelihood if they don't have a safety net, but they should feel free to speak up and to take legal action or to threaten legal action, because many women who have been discriminated against, who have taken legal action, have won, even without the Crown Act being in place. If you can prove that, for example, your work was not suffering because by the way, I'm not a lawyer, so please nobody take this as legal advice, but we do have precedents where women, men, and children have won their claims or have been reinstated in their jobs. And we're talking as far back as the 1980s when
we first saw those discrimination cases coming forward. Yes, that's really interesting. I'm just going to reintroduce you here. Author Lori Tharps with us, founded the site My American Melting Pot to showcase Black people, Black culture with us on the politics and the history of the natural hair movement. Join in on race-based hair discrimination. Your questions, your stories, welcome. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Lori Tharps here in the Ideas Network. We're discussing hair discrimination, what it means to not be respected for how you choose to wear your hair. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So it might be natural or straight, braided or a weave. Congress took action on race-based hair discrimination in March after years of advocates seeking policy change at the federal level. What can you bring to this on hair texture, on hairstyle, on systemic racism and hair? 800-642-1234. Lori Tharps co-wrote the book Hair Story about Black Hair in America and is with us on this history for the hour. Lori, we heard from Courtney in Appleton, called in and couldn't stay with us, and they said they work in HR. They conduct job interviews with a focus on equitable practices in hiring. And Courtney said that their spouse was asked during an interview to shave off their beard, and Courtney didn't think that was necessary to be asked that, and just was wondering a bit more about how you incorporate equitable practices in job interviews and in HR.
Oh yeah, that's a really good one. And that's what I do like to note that, you know, when we talk about hair discrimination, we are often talking about men, not just women, which is, again, important for people to recognize that this is not a beauty issue or just a female issue, that men are often at the receiving end of this type of discrimination. So when we are in a human resources position or any position of hiring, you want to make sure that any type of policy that you have is actually going to impact people in the same way, regardless of race or culture or religion, for example. Like, there are religions where it would be against the laws of the religion to shave one's beard. And to say that we are going to have blanket policies and met them, meet them out universally to all applicants would not be fair. We live in a diverse society, and our policies, I mean, we have to make policies that take into consideration people's racial, cultural, and religious backgrounds. We can't have an all-for-one policy. And I think that might sound, you know, at first, when you first hear that, that might sound like, well, that's just too much work. We shouldn't have to make adjustments for all these different people. But when you think about it, we have that type of, we have these different types of policies where we make adjustments for people's religious backgrounds or cultural backgrounds in other areas of our society. And to do it once means you don't have to look at every single individual instance over and over again. So really, HR people in managing and in management and hiring practices, what that means is having a diverse staff to help create the policies, so you're not both forced to, you know, examine every individual instance, which is not very efficient. And if you think about doing the work ahead of time of creating a policy that is going to be fair and equitable to everybody, because you've done your due diligence ahead of time, having a diverse group of people making these policies, then you're not looking, you're not waiting for a lawsuit, you're not waiting for, you know, somebody to cry foul. And again, this process works better and better. And again, it, at the end of the day, it requires education. So you're aware that, yeah, there are certain religions, for example, that, you know, growing the beard is part of their religious practice. So we can't just have people hacking away, hacking off their beards. Or we've read the book Hair Story, so we understand that certain hairstyles, they're not symbols of drug or gang activity. They're actually, you know, maybe cultural in origin or religious in origin. So maybe we should just think of policies like wearing hair nets, or hair should be off the face, or if one has a beard and it's longer than a certain amount, it must be tucked under. So thinking about ways that you can be culturally sensitive by having a diverse staff and by educating oneself to know what the, you know, cultural mores are for, again, different, whatever group of people that you're staff or potential employees are coming from. It just takes a little bit more work, but at the end of the day, you are actually preventing more potential problems in the future.
I'm just going to take a moment here to reintroduce you. Lori Tharps, talking about the history of race-based hair discrimination, what we see now through the Crown Act, and how companies approach inclusivity in the workplace with hair. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lori, I want to go back to the 60s because you brought up something really interesting, that, you know, the civil rights movement. And I'm wondering if you can explain how this era marked the natural hair movement. I mean, you said you've been wearing natural hair when it wasn't popular in the 90s, but with the Afro being viewed as a symbol of pride and a symbol of resistance in the Black community, what impact did that have?
Great question, because a lot of people look at the 60s with the Afro being such an iconic image as the beginning of the acceptance of natural hair in the United States for Black Americans. But that's not really true, because what the Afro did was showcase Black Americans' kind of protest, but on the body. So you didn't need a sign, you know, walking around saying, I'm really angry, we're sick of this treatment as second-class citizens. I could wear my hair and an Afro, which was a statement piece, essentially, saying, I'm no longer going to relax and straighten my hair to try to assimilate into mainstream culture because it hasn't served me. I have tried that, and I'm still being, you know, I'm still not allowed to sit at the same lunch counter. I'm still not allowed to drink out of the water fountain. I'm still not allowed to go to the better schools. So again, the Afro was a protest symbol. It had nothing to do with beauty or acceptance by mainstream society. In fact, it was meant to say, I'm not part of mainstream society. I am rebelling against, you know, a society that does not see me as fully human. Hmm. So eventually, it did become more of just a fashion trend. I mean, we look at the Jackson 5. The Jackson 5, Michael Jackson and his brothers, you know, were not up on stage protesting. And Barbara Streisand eventually, you know, wear an Afro too. And Gabe Kaplan and, you know, anybody who could wear an Afro could did. So as we know, a lot of things that start out as protests, you know, or have other meanings eventually get co-opted and turned into fashion. But the fact of the matter is, that movement in the 60s did not usher in a popularity of natural styles. That, you know, people had to wait until the early 2000s with the current natural hair movement for there to be a truly widespread acceptance of natural hairstyles in mainstream society in the United States.
Oh, I find that really interesting how you see the Afro in that way of it being politicized, also stereotyped at the same time. I want to get more into that with journalist, author, Black culture expert Lori Tharps, our guide to race-based hair discrimination, efforts to change through time, through history. Join in on Black hair as an expression of identity and culture. Join in on your role as an ally. Join in on how you see hair discrimination in your life. 800-642-1234. We will pick this up with Lori Tharps right after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're learning how natural hair discrimination perpetuates racism, perpetuates stereotypes. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Legal Defense Fund, it says Black students across the country have been asked to cut or straighten their hair to meet dress codes, to meet grooming policies. In some school districts, they have banned specific Black hairstyles, preventing students from attending school events. Share your story about race-based hair discrimination. Join in with questions about how to be an ally, which is where I'm coming from as well. 800-642-1234. Lori Tharps writes about Black Americans, Black culture at My American Melting Pot. She's here for the hour. Let's go to Ellen now in Duluth. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yes, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I have a couple of things. I'm Jewish, and I have sort of stereotypically frizzy, curly Jewish hair, so I sort of understand this from a personal standpoint. I've written a number of non-toxic living books, you know, housekeeping and beauty kind of tips to try to not poison yourself, et cetera. And I was published by New York Publishers. I had to fight really hard to be allowed to have a natural hair section in one of my books. The publishers didn't think it was an important issue. And in order to allow me to have this section of my book, I had to agree to take out an entire other section of the book. Mm. That's where I'm coming from. And I am looking at it as a cultural issue, but also it's a health issue. When you're requiring women to straighten their hair, the straightening chemicals are really toxic. So you're saying, in order to fit in, you have to poison yourself. Mm. And I'm wondering whether the author could talk about whether she thinks there's sort of a connection between this hair issue and the issue in sports with athletes like Caster Semenya, who was being required to poison herself with artificial hormones in order to be allowed to compete because her natural hormonal levels were considered wrong. And just coincidentally, pretty much all the athletes who have had that happen to them have been African.
Ellen, thank you for bringing so many points up here and looking to connect some dots. Lori, go ahead.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for that call and thank you for bringing up the very important point. I think her first point about forcing women to straighten their hair in order to, and it's, you know, it's not just to assimilate. It is, you know, if you're expecting to get a certain job, if you're expecting to, you know, stay in school, because some of these policies, you know, go down to children in the school settings where they're saying, you know, your hair should look a certain way. We see that more in professional settings, but, you know, mostly where women have to go and straighten their hair, and whether they're using harsh chemicals. And mind you, these chemicals have been proven to not only potentially cause cancer, but I've also been linked to some very severe health issues, including fibroids, that many Black women suffer from. And what's interesting is that knowing that these chemicals have been so widely used, particularly by Black women, but also by non-Black women, like the caller who said she had very frizzy Jewish hair. There's lots of women who are not Black who also use these chemical straighteners, but it's majority Black women. There really hasn't been any significant research done on the effects of these chemicals on the body, which I think is actually a discrimination issue. I mean, I think it shows the lack of care for Black women when we know that there's this entire industry catering to them, saying straighten your hair with these chemicals that may or may not be physically dangerous to your whole body and potentially, you know, your unborn children, et cetera, your fertility, all of these different things that have been shown, but there hasn't been anywhere near the amount of studies that should have been done with this product that's, you know, marketed to Black women specifically, not to mention even to young girls. So when we talk about, you know, the idea of saying, oh, you must wear your hair a certain way, we're not talking about something like you should wear one ponytail instead of two. We're talking about an entire lifestyle change. We're talking about medical potential dangers. We're talking about time and money and effort to change naturally Black hair to fit some other, to fit another person's aesthetic, which is not just an aesthetic, but we've deemed it to be the appropriate or the professional or the acceptable style. So that's why it's really important for people to recognize that when we're trying to mandate certain hairstyles, that we're not just talking about, again, oh, I'll shift my style from A to B. There's a lot, it takes a lot for a Black person to straighten their hair, to get it to the same or similar texture and potential styles as a white person, for example. And there are many textures of Black hair. I mean, every Black person doesn't have the same texture of hair, but even a Black person with maybe a looser curl pattern still has to go through lots of heat styling, flat ironing, blow drying, if they are in fact supposed to straighten their hair. And I just want to make it clear also that there are plenty of Black people who wear their hair straight because they like to, and it doesn't mean that Black people don't want to wear straight hair. It shouldn't be assumed that no Black person really wants to straighten their hair. That's one of the best things about Black hair, is it's so versatile and you can do so many different things with it. But again, mandating that there is a style that all Black people should be forced to wear in order to assimilate to a white or European beauty standard is not only unfair, but it could actually be physically dangerous.
Mm. It's interesting, too, because it was, I think, in the 80s and 90s when you see this onslaught of hair products and the Jerry curl comes into view. And it's also at a time in the 80s when you start to see some of these discrimination lawsuits starting to come out about hair. And I'm just wondering, what you see, what can you tell us about this era, this time, as to where we are today with these products and also with these lawsuits? I mean, has much changed over the decades?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely, yes. And, I mean, people always ask, have things changed? Because we do see things, seems like every other day there's a new headline about a child or a woman, a man, being fired or discriminated against. We've seen these stories of young high school students who, like you mentioned in your intro, not being able to go to prom, not being able to graduate because their hairstyles looked wrong. But that being the case, we have definitely seen progress. So with the natural hair movement, which kind of begins in the early 2000s to coincide really with the green movement overall, as Americans were becoming more green, more sustainable, going natural, you could have, your toothpaste, your body products, your beauty products, everything was natural, right? People started recycling more. It made sense that Black women in particular would start looking at their hair products and seeing, if I'm going to eat organic, why am I slathering toxic chemicals on my head? So in that ways, we are seeing more women. There's something like a 30% drop of Black women stop relaxing their hair, stop using, chemicals to straighten their hair. which is a definite benefit if we are seeing that there. I mean, and it's ironic because as more and more Black women are no longer relaxing their hair with chemicals, we are finally seeing some more actual rigorous studies looking into the dangers of these chemicals. So on that, that's the one hand. And then as far as the lawsuits, I mean, I think the Crown Act is actually the culmination of, you know, seeing these lawsuits, you know, have to go out of, you know, there's no, there is no Crown Act. So each individual lawsuit is just that. It's an individual lawsuit where people are hoping that they will win. But if you have the Crown Act in place, there will be precedent. There'll be legal precedent for a person to win their case. But I have this really great example in 2014 when the United States military debuted an updated policy for grooming standards that were specifically about beard length, but also hairstyles. And when they put out the policy, it banned certain styles that were specific to Black women, specifically dreadlocks, twists, certain braided styles, and they banned them, saying that they weren't appropriate for military service. And what happened was that there was such an outcry. My co-author, Ariana Bird, and I actually wrote a piece that was published in the New York Times, the Congressional Black Caucus. A lot of people pushed back against that policy, saying, hey, military, United States military, not a small body. Mm-hmm. You guys are misguided in your policy in that you're saying you can't wear these styles, but you can wear, they suggested that female soldiers could wear a weave, they could wear wigs, they could have their hair straightened. And it's like, obviously you don't understand hair grooming policies, because if you're out in, and this is, you know, people still active duty in the Middle East, and you're expecting a soldier to, you know, go and find a good place to get their weave done or find a good place they could plug in their hair dryer and straighten their hair, as opposed to a style like a braided style or a twisted style that can be, you know, done and left alone and tucked under the helmet and run and get to work. Once that was pointed out to the military, they went back and re-examined their policy and changed it. So this goes back to what we were talking about before about human resources. This goes back to the whole idea of education.
Voices at the table.
Many times, exactly. People, once they understand, oh, I thought this meant this. I thought people who wore those styles were, you know, again, involved with some countercultural behavior, or I thought this or that. Once people become educated, we can hope that they will then make policies that make more sense. And we are seeing that. So that is the change that I am seeing. And we are seeing, you know, Stacey Abrams, great example. You know, she's natural hair. Our newest Supreme Court justice has natural hair. So we are seeing Black women in positions of power and Black men who are no longer forced to conform to a European aesthetic and still able to be in the highest places of power.
Lori Tharps, journalist, author, with us as we discussed the nationwide legal issues around hair discrimination. Hear what it feels like to not be respected for how someone chooses to wear their hair. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Lori Tharps here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the Crown Act. We're talking about policy momentums, making it illegal to discriminate against people based on wearing hairstyles associated with race. President Biden has said he would sign the bill into law. Its path through the Senate still unclear. People choose to wear their natural hair for many reasons. We're hearing stories about race-based hair discrimination, how to be an ally, how to look at this issue. 800-642-1234 to join in. Lori Tharps is an author of multiple books on Black hair, Black culture, with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring on another caller, Richard, with us from Two Rivers. Hi, Richard. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I worked physical therapy for on the border of Mexico, Texas. And a lot of the kids or children I was working with, they give them a certain haircut to keep the hair off the sides of their heads because a lot of them came in with lice. And that's a functional haircut. And I know it's kind of off track here, but have you, I want to ask Lori if she's seen functional haircuts that became a style, you know, that's all.
Richard, thank you for that. You know, Richard addressing their lice and children given a haircut to address that, perhaps whether they want it or not, Lori.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm thinking about a functional haircut that became a fashion or stylist. I mean, if you think about, like I was mentioning before, the Afro was, you know, it was a protest hairstyle. It really wasn't meant to be a style. It was literally in the late 50s, young protesters were just not straightening their hair anymore, and they weren't making it in that perfectly round coiffed Afro that we think of Angela Davis. It was really kind of unkempt, just like I'm wearing my hair the way it came, it grew out of my head, and it eventually becomes the perfectly round Afro, you know, the bigger the better. And then it becomes a fashion statement. So in that sense, we definitely see that. Another thing is we know that early on, Black men, we're talking in antebellum America, that Black men who were more, who might have been mixed race and very light skin, their hair would be the telltale sign of whether or not they were actually, if they had any African in them. So they would shave their heads and go bald so that they, and then they could pass as white. And I would not say that anybody is shaving their heads to pass as white anymore. I shouldn't say that. Maybe they are. I don't know people's, everybody's motivations. But the idea of the bald-headed man, I mean, obviously people have done it to erase, whether it was erasing their African heritage. We know obviously that Black men and white men, you know, who are beginning to bald have shaved their heads out of a sense of, you know, to hide their baldness. But we know now that, you know, the bald-headed male is actually a look now. It's not just for those who can't grow their hair, but it is an actual, you know, fashion look for some people. So I think that over the years, we've definitely seen fashionable, or I should say practical styles. So if you look at some of the simple cornrow styles, like in Africa before European contact, the cornrows and braided styles were not simple. But when brought to the United States, cornrows became very simple styles and practical styles that could be, you know, done on a Sunday and left in the hair for the week while, you know, tending to all of the backbreaking and violence that was happening within the slave community or society, I should say. But those styles obviously have now been adapted to become, you know, visions of beauty and personal style. So I think no matter what hairstyle Black people have used in the past, they can be reimagined to become fashion statements today.
Thinking along those lines, about Kim Kardashian, who was called out for cultural appropriation after wearing, you know, tribal beads or Fulani braids a few years back. Do you view that as cultural appropriation when white people wear braided hairstyles that are customary to Black Americans?
Such a great question. And I actually was on a talk show a few years ago talking about, like, who owns braids, for example. And braids are actually a style that, you know, almost every culture has a braided style that is uniquely their own. So, you know, to say that non-Black people can't wear braided hairstyles would, of course, be foolish. And the thing about cultural appropriation, though, is when a person of another race appropriates or uses another person's cultural style, let's look at Kim Kardashian and the Fulani braids, it's one thing to wear something that is very obviously connected to another culture, and then to not acknowledge where that culture, where that hairstyle comes from. Mm. That's where the real pain point is. When a white person, for example, is heralded as, you know, starting a new trend or creating a new style, when in fact that person is wearing a style that has been traditionally associated with African American culture. And on top of that, the point that makes it even more painful is that, as we just spoke about, for many years, if a Black woman chose to wear her hair like Kim Kardashian did, she could lose her job. She could be discriminated against at work, at school, wherever, and be seen as being backwards and uncivilized for wearing a braided style. But a white woman wears the same style, and she makes the cover of a fashion magazine or today, you know, on social media, and is thought as cutting edge and look at this beautiful style. So I would not want people to think, well, I can't wear this style unless it's, I mean, if you don't feel comfortable wearing it, don't wear it. Mm-hmm. But if you are, you know, trying to wear a style that maybe you saw on a Black person, and you acknowledge the style that you're wearing is fully, you know, hey, I'm, you know, I saw this beautiful Black woman wearing it and I wanted to try it myself. You know, that's what it really comes down to, because we do live in a very multicultural society. That's my American melting pot. That's my brand, is that mm-hmm. we are always, you know, picking and borrowing and sharing. I mean, that's part of what makes American culture so unique, right? Mm-hmm. Our foods, our culture, our food, our fashion, our language even. It's so peppered with the words and the terms from different people in different cultures. That's what makes it so amazing. But when we don't give credit and we discriminate against the original creators of these different aspects of our culture, that's where the problem is. We don't want to see other people profiting off of something we get discriminated against for. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the difference. And that's what we talk about, the difference between cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation.
Oh, I like that, cultural appreciation. That's mm-hmm. such a nice movement there. We are about a minute left or so. How can people be better allies in stopping hair discrimination, whether it's in the workplace, in the school, or another part of the community?
I don't want to sound like I'm just trying to sell my book, but I really have to say that it begins with self-education. We wrote the book for people of all races and ethnicities to understand the significance of Black hair. And if you don't understand that from a starting place, then all of this just feels theoretical or maybe not related to you in any way, shape, or form. I think the way we become good allies is to put ourselves in the shoes of the people we're trying to help. Right? If I'm trying to be a better ally to my transgender friends, I'm not transgender. Nobody I know is transgender. So I can't just be a good ally by saying, like, I support my transgender friends. I need to educate myself. I need to know the language, the terminology. I need to read about people's experiences. And then I know the language, I know the wording, I know the history, and I can be a good ally and don't have to depend on the transgender community to just educate me and, you know, let them do all the work. So we just need to educate ourselves and then start from there and see what the issues are. Listen to where people need the help. If you see someone being discriminated against because of their hairstyle, speak up. Mm. It's a lot more powerful when a non-Black person says, hey, HR, did you notice that our policy says that these styles that are only for Black people are banned? That doesn't make sense. Let's revisit our policy and make it better. But again, that happens when you know the language, you know the styles, you know the history, you know the tradition. So, you know, buy the book, watch the documentary, educate yourself, and then speak up.
Lori, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Lori Tharps, journalist, author, Black culture expert. We have a link to My American Melting Pot at WPR.org/mornings. This is the Ideas Network.